Opening the public hearing on House Bill 2348. And I would ask, why don't we have Phil Schrader, or excuse me, Phil Schradl and Diane Ray come forward. How are you both this morning?
Fine.
Very well, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I'm Philip Schradl from the Department of Justice, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, and accompanying me is Diane Ray, Chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I do have some prepared testimony that Bill Taylor is passing out, but I'd like to give you just a general overview of this bill. This bill is designed to streamline the process for judicial review of Board of Parole orders and hopefully to result in substantial cost savings. A couple of legislative sessions ago, judicial review of Board of Parole orders was bifurcated. Some of those orders were left, so they went directly to the Court of Appeals on direct Court of Appeals review. And a number of other kinds of board orders were taken out of that process. The result of that legislative change a couple of sessions ago meant that those cases went through circuit court proceedings, and they kind of got forced into habeas corpus petitions. That was the form of judicial review that people sought. That meant that there was a trial on a habeas corpus petition in the trial court, and then those cases were routinely appealed back to the Court of Appeals. And that resulted really in redundant steps of judicial review, and that circuit court proceeding is a costly piece of the process. This bill is designed to make all Board of Parole orders directly reviewed in the Court of Appeals. And we anticipate that that process will save during a biennium about $450,000 worth of costs that we bill to the Department of Corrections for that trial level of the habeas corpus proceeding. The appeals from those will still occur, but they'll occur in a different form. They won't occur coming out of the trial court in habeas corpus, but they'll occur directly on judicial review. So the appellate piece of that should stay about the same. One other piece of information before I go through the bill in a little more detail. We anticipate that it will take approximately about a year for the cases that currently would be in the pipeline on the effective date of this statute, if this bill goes into effect, about a year for those cases that are in the habeas corpus trial court proceeding pipeline to clear out of the system. So the full cost savings probably won't occur for a year after the effective date of this statute. We anticipate that in subsequent biennium that we would anticipate about a $450,000 or more as cost increase savings per year. Can walk you real quickly just through the bill. We've deleted subsection 2 of ORS 144-335, and that's what really had taken those cases out of direct judicial review. So that piece just brings them back into direct judicial review. And we have instituted in the bill a process for a motion practice. And the motion practice that you see there is in subsection 6, where there's a require the inmate to file a motion for leave to proceed. We've tried to build into this process a couple of steps where you could have some substantial screening of cases. Quite often, inmates will file challenges, and there really turns out to be no merit to those claims at all. But under the current system, you have to have a habeas corpus trial proceeding and potentially an appeal. This motion for leave to proceed would be a mechanism by which the Court of Appeals could determine in a streamlined manner whether there is any merit there. Not make an ultimate decision on the merits, but just determine whether there is any colorable claim there. And if there is a claim there, then we allow it to go forward. But this screening mechanism is another piece in this that would help, hopefully, to have substantial cost savings. Subsection 7, the new subsection 7, augments the Court of Appeals' ability to dispose of non-meritorious cases by allowing one judge to make that determination. That is a statutory tweak, if you will, that needs to occur so that not right now the only way that the appellate court can make decisions is through three-judge panels. We believe that this would also be a cost-saving mechanism that's built in here, only as the screening function to take out cases that have no merit. Then we've had some additional cost-saving things that we've tried to put in through subsection 5, where the Board of Parole would not provide a written transcript, but only an audio record at the time of that motion practice. Currently, the normal practice would be that you'd have to prepare a written transcript before anything can occur in the case. And this motions practice would, hopefully, again, avoid the cost of preparing the transcript. And then also a couple of other kind of conforming changes that occur in the bill, wherein subsection 9 allows the court to summarily affirm the board's order even after the brief has been filed if it appears that there is no substantial issue raised. And in subsection 12, there's authorization for the court to impose costs. And it is kind of a step process because if the challenger, if the petitioner carries his case all the way through the briefing stage and it's ultimately determined there was no merit there, that then they could be assessed with a $100 attorney fee as well as costs. If they have determined that their claim really doesn't have any merit and they drop it before they need to go through the entire briefing process, which entails our office filing a response, their attorney having filed a brief, and the court being involved in a decision on the merits, if they avoid all of those circumstances and dismiss their case out early, they'd avoid any assessment of costs or attorney's fees. And we think that financial incentive would again serve as a screening function to help avoid the need to carry on through with unmeritorious claims. And section 2 is an amendment to the habeas corpus statute just so that it is made very clear that if someone goes through this judicial review process or had the opportunity to go through this judicial review process and failed to do so, that is a determination of their claim on the merits for purposes of precluding them from subsequently bringing a habeas corpus claim. That, again, is a mechanistic way of reducing costs in this area. And finally, Section 3 just makes the bill apply prospectively only. And that prospective date is what requires that there be this one-year lag of time. Up until the effective date of this bill, if it goes into effect, there still will be the opportunity for habeas corpus petitions to be filed up till that date. And that, so the savings really won't be seen in full for a year period after that. But we strongly encourage you to move this bill forward with a due pass recommendation. It will not have any effect upon the ability of inmates to get judicial review. It will not have any effect on their ability to raise claims on judicial review. The only thing it does is eliminates a cumbersome and time-consuming and a resource-expensive process of the habeas corpus trial. The inmates will, in fact, I think, be better served because currently, with the habeas corpus kind of practice, there are a number of procedural hurdles that need to be overcome. Habeas cases can go moot. Sometimes the claims that they want to raise just aren't recognizable as a habeas corpus claim, but could be raised on direct judicial review. So I think this bill would get decisions on the merits of inmates' claims more often, quicker, and at much less time and expense for the entire system, our office, public, and the court system as well.
Great. Thank you, Phil. Diane, did you have something you wanted to add?
Just briefly.
Just to respond to... Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Diane Ram, Chair of the Board of Parole, and I just wanted to tell you that when this issue was brought to us and just the way that Mr. Schradl framed it, we decided that it was a good thing to support. I mean, I think overall it's good government and good use of state resources. Our only concern, obviously, would be the fiscal impact to the board because... while there may be a savings to DOC who's now handling all of this, if we go back to full direct judicial review of all board orders, there will be an increase in our bills, our AG bills. And so if they're, whether that's going to be a transfer of funds from DOC or not, this will work well if it's funded for the board. So that's all.
Just one quick question, and then I have to step out for a minute. But I can't recall, and maybe you can help me, Diane. Was this an issue that we had a hearing on during the interim, in front of the interim judiciary committee, or was this actually in some form up last session?
I believe, Mr. Chair, I believe it was dealt with in the interim.
Okay.
I don't recall
so
the last session.
We had a hearing in the interim about it. Okay. Because
yeah.
It all seems very familiar to me, but I can't recall exactly where it was.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me give you a little bit of history on this. The Ways and Means Committee last session put a budget note in the budgets of the Department of Justice and I believe the Judicial Department and asked the Judiciary Committee to form a work group to develop legislation in this area. This is one of the bills. You heard one of the other bills last week.
We're going to hear later then from some other people that are in opposition to this. What would be, from your point of view, what would be the opposition?
Chair Williams in absentia and Representative Krieger. Frankly, I'm not sure what opposition there might be, because it seems to me that this bill would get the courts to focus on the merits of the board order without a lot of procedural kind of hurdles to overcome. And it should do it quicker and more cost-effective. For an example, right now we have the board sometimes will establish a person's initial parole release date and, for example, suggest that it's 2010 as their parole release date. Well, a subsequent board order, for reasons substantiating it, may extend that and make the parole release date 2020. Currently under habeas, the habeas petition, it wouldn't be a recognizable claim because it doesn't demand immediate judicial scrutiny. Nothing's going to happen to this person at the earliest until 2010 if the person is correct. Under this bill, they'd be able to get access to a challenge and a judicial review of whether the board correctly extended them out until 2020. And I think other kinds of examples like that would be there too. I don't know what opposition there would be.
Okay, thank you. Just a question, Mr. Vice Chair and members of the panel. Could you give us any idea, maybe in a subsequent memo, as to what the caseload is, what the caseload savings may be, or give us some idea what the economies might be as a result of this bill?
Certainly. Representative Ackerman, we anticipate that by eliminating the habeas corpus trial level of the proceeding, that about $450,000 that currently gets billed to the Department of Corrections per biennium would be saved.
That's in the habeas corpus proceedings alone?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And the appeals from those habeas corpus trial proceedings now would be basically transferred over and we would have this direct judicial review. So we would still experience the cost there, but about $450,000 per biennium. And again, I think that would be phased in over a one-year period because we still have the habeas corpus cases in the pipeline.
Okay. And just to follow up, that $450,000 would include probably mostly legal fees on both sides. Is that what you'd anticipate?
No, that, Representative Ackerman, that is just the DOJ billing costs to the Department of Corrections on the habeas corpus cases.
So would be some savings on the public defender side? I assume these folks have counsel.
Representative Ackerman, I believe that most often in these habeas cases that they are appointed counsel through the Indigent Defense Fund.
Fine.
And I believe that Ms. Kristen from the Indigent Defense Fund will be providing you information about that, too. But there should be savings on that side, too.
Okay,
Representative Ackerman, there would also, I'm not sure if the $450,000 that Mr. Schradl's mentioning includes there would be an increased cost to the board, and our current estimate of increase to the board is about $350,000 over the next biennium.
Let me,
I don't know if that includes that or not.
Yeah, Representative Ackerman, let me follow up with that, because currently the appellate portion of the for the habeas corpus. The habeas corpus cases go through a trial proceeding and then an appeal. The appeal portion of that will basically be a transfer over to cover, hopefully, I mean, we need to find a funding source for it, whether it's from the Department of Corrections or some other source. Corrections will also not experience that appellate piece of it, so that there should be some funding available.
And just a couple of follow-up questions. What percentage of the current issues here or cases would be frivolous, not non-meritorious?
Representative Ackerman, I really can't give you a firm figure on that. We do currently file motions to dismiss in the appellate court on habeas corpus cases, and you know, it's a percentage, but I don't know. That would be a tough one. I mean, you know, 20%. That's a guess, and that's because a number of those cases go moot while they're in the judicial system.
One last one.
If you wouldn't mind, I could do some research if you want me.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, I'm trying to anticipate if this bill passes to the floor, someone's going to ask these questions, okay? And if we could have a memo to us, I think, that we could put in our files, it will help the carrier of the bill.
Yes. Representative Ackerman, I believe that Paul Siebrist is working on putting together a fiscal impact.
Fine, thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, Phil, I know each inmate has a right to file a federal habeas corpus petition. I think I've heard that right depends on what process and procedures we have in the state. That's correct. How will this bill affect that?
Members of the committee, Mr. Taylor, I believe that should suffice if they exhausted this judicial review proceeding, that couldn't, you know, they could then go to federal habeas. If they didn't exhaust this, I believe they'd be out because they have to, you know, for a failure to exhaust. I think this suffices for that.
Any further questions? Representative Lowe, do you have something?
Is it done this way to the best of your knowledge in some other states? Do other states have this mechanism?
Members of the committee, Representative Lowe, this is how it used to be. In Oregon, a couple of legislative sessions ago, these Board of Parole Board orders were bifurcated. Some of them were left with direct judicial review. Others were routed elsewhere. As it turns out, they went to habeas corpus.
So the constitutionality has been tested.
Representative Lowe, to my knowledge, I don't think there is ever, I don't know that there's been a constitutional question raised, but I'm confident that it would pass constitutional muster.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Raylan? Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dave is Broden and Jesse Barton. Come up, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Groom. I'm director of the State Public Defender's Office. With me is Chief Deputy Jess Barton. If this bill were to pass, the large majority of the cases would come back to us, which was the case several years ago before the case of Quintero, which was the one that the Court of Appeals divested itself of jurisdiction in these cases, thereby leading to most of the inmates filing in habeas corpus. We don't handle in our office any state habeas corpus, either at the trial level or on appeal. So all of those cases are now going to the Indigent Defense Fund for appointment. Ms. Christian is here, and I'm sure she'll have figures as to how much that costs the system at this point. The way I look at this is it boils down to two kind of separate things for me. First of all, whether or not this is a good idea, and then whether or not we're happy taking all these cases back. As to the first part, I think this bill probably is a good idea from the system standpoint. It does reduce the number of court appearances that are made in this type of case and would funnel everything to a judicial review from the board action form. Whether or not our office would be thrilled about the prospect of getting all these cases back, that there is going to be a financial impact on us. At the present time, we handle the judicial review of cases that still qualify under the Court of Appeals jurisdiction. And Jess is going to give you the figures on how many we're handling now and how many, what an increase that would be in our caseload. The financial impact would I think, cause us some problems in terms of our staff. We don't have enough attorneys on staff presently to be able to absorb these cases without an increase in our staffing. And the way we've got it figured is it would take us two more FTE attorneys and one secretary. Jess will give you the figures on that. And before I turn it over to him to go ahead and give you the details, I did want to make two comments on the bill as it's drafted right now. First of all, I heard that Mr. Schradl state that these cases would come up on audio record, and we would very much oppose any system that didn't provide a written transcript for our attorneys to work from. There is a great deal of difficulty in trying to make an appeal from an audio record. We just recently got away from that in the misdemeanor direct appeal area, and when we got into written transcripts, it improved our office's efficiency greatly. The other point of opposition that I would mention is we will always oppose any cost to the inmate simply because it's unfair to impose a cost on somebody who's already been determined indigent, and to then penalize them for exercising their right would create a chilling effect on that right. With that said, I'd like to ask Jess Barton to go ahead and talk about the figures on the fiscal impact.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've estimated presently we're taking about 45 parole appeal cases a year. And if this bill passes, our parole caseload would shoot up to about, we're estimating now, relying on data that was given us by the Department of Justice last summer, which, from what I understand, may be updated, but relying on that possibly outdated data, we're expecting our caseload to increase, our parole caseload to increase from 45 cases a year up to 170. So it's, you know, we're going to guess, say, we're going to say something like, is that 120 cases a year increase in cases. We're estimating now that the time an attorney would spend on each case would be 35 hours per case. So 35 hours times 120 cases is 4,165 hours. That's enough time to keep two attorneys busy full-time for a year. And each two attorneys in our office get one support staff, one secretary. So that's how we get this number of two full-time equivalent attorneys and one full-time equivalent secretary. But that's based on the projection that the attorneys will spend 35 hours per case. If all we get is an audio record, that's not going to be enough. Audio records are much more difficult to review than written transcripts, take much more time. So the 35-hour figure would be too low. But using the 35-hour figure, we finally end up estimating that the cost to our agency of filling these or having these three new positions would be, well, once the bill's fully implemented, $386,105. I provided that information to Paul Siebert at Legislative Fiscal yesterday. He's using it in developing the Legislative Fiscal's impact statement on this particular bill.
Representative Shetterly.
That's the fiscal impact on your office. I guess on a statewide basis, I mean, these cases are being done now. So I assume that, and maybe this is a better question for Ann Christian, but the state is paying for those out in on a private contract basis or through other appellate defender attorneys. Is that correct?
That's correct. It would not be, Mr. Representative Shetterly, it would not be any other appellate defenders out there. It would be people mostly in private practice or perhaps by contract.
Well, that'll be interesting to hear. I understand the fiscal impact on your office. And, in fact, I know I was in the work group meeting a few times and we talked about that. If we look at it as on a statewide basis, I think that's where we have to judge the fiscal impact. And then if there's going to be a need to accommodate the increased workload in your office, then obviously Ways and Means is going to have to step up and fund that if we're asking you to take on that additional burden.
Are there any other questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the panel. I just have a couple of questions about this process. Isn't it true that the records in these cases, since we're only talking about final orders from the board, are rather limited in scope, or are they quite substantial? I'm talking about the written record as well as the testimony that might find its way on an audio tape or a transcript.
Representative Ackerman, yes, the record is limited to the administrative procedure that the board uses to provide due process. It goes through and allows, of course, the inmate to speak. And I quite frankly am not aware that that witnesses are permitted to speak unless it's under the victim's rights bill, to allowing the victims the opportunity to address the board.
And typically, how long do these hearings last before the board?
Representative Ackerman, in my limited experience with these, it varies. They can be very short, and I would suspect that many of them are. However, I am aware that we've gotten transcripts that are up to 150, 200 pages, which indicates a pretty much close to a full-day hearing.
Okay. That's all I have.
Okay. Mr. Taylor?
Chair, Mr. Committee, Mr. Grimm, when you get records from the parole board now, do you get audio copies or do you get transcripts?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, we get written transcripts.
Any other questions in this panel?
Representative
Walker.
Yeah, I was just computing that. If it's a 150-page transcript, I generally get 35 pages of transcript per hour. So that will tell you approximately how many hours that would be. So 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah. Representative Walker, that sounds correct to me.
Thank you very much.
If I may, Mr.
Please.
Chair, one final point. We did have some amendments that we distributed, and I'm going to ask once again Mr. Barton to talk about these.
Mr. Chairman, I actually spoke with Mr. Taylor about this briefly yesterday. In the course of our working with the work group last summer on this particular bill, we identified a problem we currently have with our parole appeals, which will become larger if amendments like these aren't actually enacted. The way it works now is we're appointed to, or we're, I should say, titularly appointed to parole cases under ORS 144337. That's shown on the amendments that should have been distributed a few minutes ago. There's actually nothing wrong with that statute, and that statute requires us or authorizes us to represent inmates or parolees in their appeals pursuant to the terms of our charter statutes, the ones you see, the series 151210 to 290. And in the middle of those is 151250. Subsection 4 requires us to seek appointment from the court or magistrate before whom a proceeding is pending or to whom an application for relief has been made. In a parole appeal case, that would be the Court of Appeals. We're to seek appointment from that court in parole appeal cases. I know the court disagrees with me on that, but I'm confident that my construction is right. But in any event, the court believes that if we're going to have the Court of Appeals appointing us in these cases, we need an amendment, and so I've proposed an amendment so stating. The way the system's gone in the past is that we've taken parole cases without first getting any kind of judicial determination about the inmate's or the parolee's ability to pay, his ability to hire his own counsel. So conceivably, and it's not beyond imagination, we've over the years have represented various parolees who could have afforded to have hired counsel. The second amendment we're asking is to ORS 151450. That statute, the way that works, the way the cases normally work, the cases that come up on appeal, is that if we're unable to serve in a case because, say, for example, a conflict of interest, we conflict off the case and substitute counsel is appointed, and substitute counsel is paid by the Indigent Defense Fund. And this amendment would ensure that in parole appeal cases, the substitute counsel would be paid by the Indigent Defense Fund. We conflict off about one out of every 60 cases, so So assuming that we get 170 parole cases per year, we're going to estimate, you know, the high end, we're going to conflict off, say, 3 cases per year. And that, at using the $35 hourly rate, is going to, and then the 35 hour per case average, and then the $40 hourly rate for court appointed work, the hourly cost of these conflict cases would be $4,200. That's the sum total of the amendments we're proposing.
Okay. Any questions about the amendments? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Appreciate you coming to testify. Our last witness on this bill is Jim Nass from the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals. Yeah, and you're welcome to come up, too, if you'd like. You bet. I have Jim down as a 4 on this bill. Is that right? You're supportive.
Correct,
as well?
Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the appellate courts, and I was part of the work group that worked on developing this bill. I'm not going to restate what the previous witnesses have said, and I will only address my comments to those issues that have been raised. Representative Krieger, you asked who would be opposed to this bill. Apart from the reservations that the state public defender had, the somewhat facetious answer is me. And the reason I would be is because a large part of my job at the court is to handle the court's motions practice. And one thing that this bill will do is transfer a lot of the work that is now being done by circuit judges and the appellate judges to motions practice. Notwithstanding that it will increase my personal workload from an institutional point of view, this is a good bill. Most of these cases do not raise substantial questions of law, and when you have cases that do not raise questions of law, you should not have circuit and appellate court judge time working on those cases. The standard of substantial question of law is one that we also use in direct criminal appeal cases, habeas corpus cases, and post-conviction relief cases. And I can tell you, if you have any concerns about whether the court is screening out cases that they should handle, is that if anybody has any doubt about whether or not a case raises a substantial question of law, we allow the case to go forward to full briefing. The appellate model is that you have 3 judges who sit and decide a case, and for better or for worse, that's the model that we follow. And so, as I said, if we have any doubt as to whether a case raises a question of law that should be considered by the court, we allow that case to go forward. Nevertheless, most of the cases in our experience do not raise a substantial question of law, and frankly, that was the reason why back in 1993 and 1995 we supported the effort of removing direct judicial review of these cases. Unfortunately, that had the side effect of driving these cases into habeas corpus. Representative Lowe asked about whether there were any constitutional issues here, and that was the one. There is this doctrine called separation of powers, which says that one branch of government cannot perform the functions of another branch, and the function of deciding individual cases is a function of the judicial branch. Under the separation of powers doctrine, it's constitutional for the legislature to delegate to the administrative or executive branch the power to decide individual cases, provided that at some opportunity there can be judicial review. But once we eliminate a direct judicial review of many of these kinds of cases, inmates were entitled to judicial review somewhere, and the remedy that they chose was habeas corpus, and that was helpful for them because they are entitled to court-appointed counsel. So as previous witnesses have described, that led to incurring substantial costs in the trial court, first to pay for judge time and staff time, but also to pay for court-appointed counsel and for attorney general time. And as has been stated, most of those cases come up on appeal anyway, so we end up taking a second look at them. So this is a good bill because it eliminates one whole level of court review and all the costs that go along with it. Let me address this one other point, and that's the issue of transcripts. Under the bill, the case, when the case is initially filed, the inmate has 60 days after the record is filed to file this motion seeking leave to proceed. At that point, all the board would do was furnish an audio record. And so it is true that at that point, the state public defender will only have the audio record to work with. But its only role at that point is to determine whether the case raises a question of law. If the court determines that the case does raise a sufficient question of law, at that point a transcript will be done and the case will go forward to full briefing on a written transcript. And that is part of the cost savings, so that we don't have to do a transcript, that the board doesn't have to pay for the cost of a transcript for every single one of these cases that are filed. I guess I do have one other comment. Since the burden of handling the bulk of these cases will fall on the state public defender's office, it is imperative that that office receive adequate funding to handle what will be a very significant increase in its workload. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Vicki Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nass, I'm a little out to lunch today, but I think I heard you say that you'll provide the audio record, and then they'll determine if there's a substantial action under the law to proceed. But that requires the public defender's office to review the audio tape to decide whether there's a substantial case under the law. And that's pretty hard stuff to do, to sit there and listen to, especially if the hearing was 4 hours long. Don't you agree that that's a hardship?
Representative Walker, parole board proceedings, in order to get judicial review, the inmate must seek administrative review of the order first. And it is frequently at that stage, which has to be in writing, that the inmate will identify the issues. And so in my experience, frequently the issues are very obvious from the paperwork, and that it frequently will not be necessary to resort to a transcript. As I recall, this bill does authorize the court on request of the state public defender to have a transcript done if they feel they need to have a transcript done in order to make their preliminary showing.
Can you point that out to me in the bill? Because I didn't read that part, and I don't recall the public defenders talking about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think this language, at least the area, is set forth in page 2, subsection 5.
Mm-hmm.
It's on page 2 at lines 36 to 38. The court may direct the board to file the audio record or a transcript of the audio record needed to dispose of the motion for leave to proceed with judicial review.
Well, I'm still having trouble here, because in order to make a decision whether to go forward, they need to review the proceedings.
But Representative Walker, it was my understanding that those who were participating in the work group understood that in most of these cases a transcript would not be necessary in order to make that
initial determination
preliminary showing. After the court determined that the case did raise an issue of law, then the transcript would be done, and it would go on to briefing.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate that explanation, but I would like to hear back from the Public Defender Office in response to what you've stated here.
There are other questions for Mr. Nance or Ms. Christian? Okay, thank you, Jim. Actually, I'd like to get Jess here. Are you still here? Yeah, great. I'd like to get you to come forward if you would. And then Phil or Diane, could one of you come up, or both of you? I've just got a couple of questions about, I'm trying to get a handle on, and I know this is more a ways and means question, but I want to understand the costs versus the savings and whether or not we're saving any money or if all we're doing is really just shifting it among agencies. Those are questions I sort of have an interest in. So first, Representative Walker, you had a question, I believe, for Mr. Barton.
Right. Can you address the concern that I raised with Mr. Nash?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, it's a great concern of ours. We'll have to review that audio record in every case. No matter how long it is, we have to review it. We can't just skip over that any more than we can skip over any other part of the record that we need to review to determine whether the case presents a substantial question of law.
That's exactly what I thought you would have to do, Mr. Barton, and I thank you for answering that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, if I could just add a little piece to that. Diane Ray, I'm chair of the Board of Parole.
Your name again?
Diane Ray, and I'm chair of the Board of Parole, and I regularly attend the parole board hearings. And I say that only because there's been some testimony about length of parole board hearings, and I would say the average length of our hearing is about half an hour. It is not unusual for us to go to an hour. I think in the 3 years that I've been on the board, the longest hearing I've ever been in is about an hour and a half. So talk of a half day or a full day hearing, thankfully, haven't ever occurred while I've been on the board. So. And the hearings are longer now than they've been in the past just because of the nature of the cases and the volume of the record that we consider. So if that helps you in your consideration, I want to offer that.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I appreciate that explanation. And as I indicated, as a court reporter, I get about 35 pages of transcript to the hour. And so if you're talking about a half an hour hearing, it's maybe 20 pages when you add your caption and your certification page. So it just doesn't seem like a whole lot of investment to me, particularly when the state of Oregon uses this audio reporting sort of thing anyway to save costs, which I don't really approve of, but we're not going to go down that road today. And I know what it's like to listen to an audio recording because I've had attorneys who use audio recordings and then they call me up and say, I can't deal with this. Can you transcribe it for me? And it's very difficult to do that. So I just don't feel like I want to make the Public Defender's Office have to go to all that trouble to get those transcribed.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, we somewhat share that concern because I'm equally concerned about having one of our staff devoted almost full time who isn't, an expert in the field. It's just a staff person that we have listen to the tape and transcribe. So there would be an increased burden of our office as well, and that was why when we were working on this bill, it was our understanding that we wouldn't have to transcribe every single case until it was determined that there was a substantial question of law, because I was concerned about the drain on our agency of having someone, if they're talking about 170 cases a year full-time, typing up an entire transcript, even of a 30 or 60-minute hearing for a case that an attorney would then read and say, well, this isn't even raising a substantial question of law. So it is a real concern, and it's one we share, and that's why I thought we had reached this balance that the tape would be provided just as a threshold matter, and then when it was determined there was a substantial question of law, we had no problem at all providing a full written transcript for a case that was going to go to full briefing. So.
But do you understand the catch-22 here?
I do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Jesse, I understood you to say that you think your agency or your outfit will have a $386,000 is that biennial or is that annual?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that would be biennial,
okay,
but after full implementation of this bill.
Right.
So, it, you know, the first, or the 01-03 biennium, I guess it would just be three-fourths of that amount.
Right. Okay. And, Phil, I remember, I thought from your testimony indicating somewhere around $450,000 in savings that you thought would be achieved by this implementation.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, the $450,000 figure is what we currently bill to the Department of Corrections on a biennial basis for the trial level of the habeas corpus petitions. What that doesn't cover is the other side's costs associated with that trial. That's just the state side costs. And I thought potentially that Ann Christian was here, who was going to, I thought, provide some information from the Indigent Defense Fund figures. But currently, counsel who represent the inmates on these parole matters are typically appointed through the Indigent Defense Fund, and those dollar figures aren't included in that $450,000 at all. And so I assume that there will be, you know, some substantial savings.
Pull up an extra chair. Stay there, Diane.
Yeah.
Yeah, have her pull up an extra chair. We can all fit up there. Sorry, keep going, Phil.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that there will be substantial savings on the other side's trial costs, too, by eliminating the trial proceeding in its entirety. I mean, basically what this bill would do is take the appellate piece of the currently existing structure and just move it to direct judicial review, but eliminate entirely the trial court proceeding. And so the figures that I was using before were simply what we bill to the Department of Corrections to handle those habeas corpus petitions, not the other side's costs.
Right. And will there be, do you pick up any additional work as a result of these changes?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, we anticipate it would be just about the same. Virtually all of the habeas cases currently go on to appeal. We anticipate that those would now be challenged on direct judicial review. So we anticipate that the appellate cost will be about the same.
Okay, so no change on that side. All right. And do you anticipate savings?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm director of the Indigent Defense Services Division. And the anticipated savings, although legislative fiscal is trying to revise these figures, but based upon Department of Justice figures and the current costs that we incur, the Indigent Defense Account incurs, I'll take first the trial level habeas, which would be absolute savings. When fully implemented, the cost avoidance to the Indigent Defense Account for the trial level habeas would be almost $160,000. And that's on a full biennial basis. At the appellate level, since the state public defender would be taking over the responsibility for the appellate cases, our projected savings to the Indigent Defense Account would be $125,000. And again, that's on a full biennial basis.
Okay, so I'm adding up savings here.
So far I'm
about $735,000. And then you got to back out of that, as I understand it, Jesse, $386,000. Am I missing any piece of this? Any piece of it ended up in somebody else's pocket?
Chair Williams, the one thing to make sure that the committee and you understand, too, is that associated with that, too, would be a need to transfer money that is currently in the Department of Corrections to the Board of Parole, because the appeals from habeas cases are currently billed to the Department of Corrections by our office. Under this bill, they would be billed to the Board of Parole because it would be direct judicial review of the Board of Parole. That would not be a savings one way or the other, but a transfer.
So, Diane, your budget picks up a hit then as a result of this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're just very rough estimates, estimating about $340,000 for the next biennium. If that money is a direct transfer from the Department of Corrections, then obviously there's no hit to the general fund. If it's not, then there is. So that $340,000 has got to come to our budget from somewhere. And the theory would be that the savings to the Department of Corrections. And if it,
and Department of Corrections will willingly send it your way.
Mr. Chair, I'm not here to speak on behalf of
Department
of Corrections. And that's why I'm voicing my concern.
Well, and I don't... Jim, I want you to either nod or shake your head. You seem to indicate that there would be an additional motion practice for the Court of Appeals in this. So you guys are going to take an increased
financial hit as a result of cases now. Is that right? Oh, now you're coming up. Okay, we'll switch places with Ann.
Ms. Chair, this is Jim Nass. Currently, most of those appeals either go to a three-judge panel. Some are resolved by a motion for summary affirmance, which, if granted, must be done by a three-judge panel also. This bill should result in some, in a fairly significant less work for three-judge panels if we are right that most of these cases can be screened out at the motion level. There'll be more work for me and my staff, and we may need to do something internally to account for that, but there should be some less work for judges.
Chair, well, I'm so hard to translate less work for judges into department savings.
I think it's fair to say that it isn't any savings because they'll simply work on something else.
Right.
Chair Williams, if I might add a comment, that what would also be eliminated by eliminating the trial court proceeding in the habeas corpus matter would be the trial court work and the trial court judicial system time and expense of dealing with those cases as well.
You know what would be helpful for me? Did you have a question, Representative Shetterly?
No.
What would be helpful for me and I want to ask one more question about this whole transcript issue, but it would be sort of helpful for me on one page, if maybe all of you could get together and sort of show the puts and takes in what this change would amount to within the budget cycle. Representative Shetterly.
I understood there is a fiscal impact statement. That ought to give us the...
But we don't have it yet.
No, but I mean, it's in the works, right?
Right.
Okay. Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, members of the committee, yes, we're working with Paul Siebert currently, okay. And we can put that together for you quickly,
right.
I think.
Representative Lowe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I'm contemplating the question of whether or not a cost assessment should be made against the unsuccessful movement, do the anticipated savings or costs that we're trying to sit here and calculate include a consideration of fees and costs to be received from the defendant or not?
Chair Williams, Representative Lowe, I'll take a crack at that. I don't believe they do.
Okay.
I don't think there was any anticipated, you know, revenue-generating piece of that from the cost that might be assessed.
So the success or failure of this enterprise that we're contemplating does not hinge on any contribution from the movement?
Chair Williams, Representative Lowe, no.
Thank you.
So as I said, the puts and takes would be really helpful, and I imagine you're having to produce that information for Mr. Siebert anyway, so it would be helpful if you could maybe put it in some sort of a single-page format for us. The last question I've got is with respect to this audio tape versus transcript. How much of the savings, Phil, do you think come from not having to transcribe those hearings? How much of the savings, or how much money are we spending on transcription right now that you think you're going to avoid by putting this thing on tape? Do you know the answer to that, Ann?
I do.
See, I'm having a heck of a time figuring out which one of you knows the answer to which question. That's why I need it on one page.
Mr. Chair, and Christian, Indigent Defense. Indigent Defense is responsible for paying for transcripts in any case that the state public defender handles or that Indigent Defense handles. And it was interesting when we looked at the transcript costs in the trial-level habeas cases that went up to the Court of Appeals, interesting because the transcript costs were so low. It's about $5,000 per full biennium. And I know that seems way too low, and we've double-checked, and I guess it's in part because many of the courts use audio records.
They're currently using audio records.
Correct.
Go ahead, Diane.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if Ann's comments are related to the trial court proceeding or to the board hearing. We do our... Yes, to trial courts. We do our own transcripts of our own hearings,
right,
from our audio tapes.
Right.
If we were to do those on every single case that could be directly appealed to the Court of Appeals, every single case that Mr. Barton would review, that I believe is going to increase the overall cost to us, because I don't currently have an employee who could do that volume of transcript currently. I have an employee who could do the volume of transcript that we anticipated if we were only transcribing the ones that met the substantial question of law and would go to full briefing. We could absorb that, but I don't believe without further funds we could absorb the other.
Mr. Barton, what's your response to that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if we're talking about 170 appeals per year, and if the average transcript length is 20 pages, that's 3,400 pages. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Indigent Defense pays transcribers $3 per page. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, it's $2.50 per original page and 25 cents for each copy, usually two copies.
I don't have a calculator to do 250, but I use $3 a page, so that's $10,200 per year for transcripts. And then recognize also that some of those transcripts are going to be made anyway, even as the bill is currently written. So the actual net cost of always requiring a transcript will be less than $10,200.
Do you agree with Mr. Barton's figures, Diane, or do you not?
Mr. Chair, I have no reason to doubt Mr. Barton's figures. And again, if the funding piece is taken care of, then you know, we're fine with the bill. We're just trying to raise the red flag where we can. And if I don't have any information about having it transcribed outside of our agency, right. We try to do it within our agency
right.
to use the resources that we have.
Right. I guess my concern is that if it's relatively inexpensive to get someone to actually put the words on the page, and that's going to cause a more expensive individual who's being paid at although low, but still at an attorney's rate, to the extent that we're utilizing that individual's time as effectively as possible to get a fairly inexpensive person to be doing the transcription, that seems to make more sense to me. But I guess I'd like you guys to work that out a little bit. We're not a Ways and Means Committee here, and I've asked you a lot of questions about money as opposed to the policy, but I've decided that based on our current budget scenario, I'm not going to be in the business of schlepping stuff down to the Ways and Means Committee when I don't think I can actually go to the chairman of the committee and make the argument as to why I've even referred a bill down to his committee to be implemented. So I am going to be fairly specific about cost questions in this committee on top of the policy issues, because if it's got a big fiscal impact and we can't make the policy argument and understand the fiscal, I'm not even going to bother to send it down. So that's, I guess, my statement to you, and I'd encourage you to come back with that information. Work with Mr. Taylor in discussion with the amendments that you've asked for, Mr. Barton, and we'll put the bill back up for a hearing. Is there any other questions, Representative Shirley? You were positing a question, I believe.
No, I think I'm okay. Just an observation that I think the issue of the transcript costs obviously boils down to who's going to do it. Substantially more if it stays in-house, substantially less if it goes through Ann Christian's shop, so that's something I'll need to work on, too.
Chair Williams, one final comment on that. I mean, in terms of, I don't think there's a philosophical difference about that at all. It was simply a cost item, and if the, you know, the funding is there and can be handled, it certainly doesn't affect how the bill works or,
right.
or anything.
Right. And Mr. Taylor pointed out to me that this doesn't necessarily have a Ways and Means referral on it, but I always hesitate before I have a fiscal in my hand to know what the impact is. And I would suspect Diane wants it to go to the Ways and Means because she wants that $340,000 out of the Department of Corrections budget. And if that's what we're anticipating happening, then I think we at least need to have a conversation with the Ways and Means Public Safety Committee about this issue. So I'm not suggesting I'll put a referral to Ways and Means on the bill if we think we can work those details out without it. But if not, that's probably what's going to have to happen. And you want to
Mr.
say
Chair,
something?
One quick comment. In response to Representative Shetterly's comment about who pays for the transcript, the $2.50 per page that I quoted that Indigent Defense pays, just want to say is a statutory amount. We have no control over the amount.
Great. Thank you all very much. Very interesting. Okay, going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2348, and we will open the public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill. My gosh, is this our first Senate bill?
It is.
Council?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
On Senate Bill 74. Go ahead, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Swank is here in Senate Bill 74. What it does allows a grand jury to receive a court employee's affidavit into evidence when the grand jury is investigating charges of failure to appear. Allows the court to send notice to DMV to suspend a person's driver's license for failing to appear on a traffic violation citation without rescheduling the trial on the citation.
OK.
Chair Williams, members of the committee for the, I'm sorry, I'm jumping the gun. Is all right?
Good morning, Mr. Swank. You are the only person signed up for this bill. Mr. Taylor, did this bill pass unanimously in the Senate?
I believe it did.
It did. Well, there, one person was excused for business. Yes.
Okay. You have 5 minutes, Mr. Swank.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. This bill makes two minor improvements to the process on failure to appear, both of which counsel has explained. The first one allows court personnel to appear before a grand jury in a failure to appear case by affidavit in the same way that police officers are allowed to appear, saving court clerk time. The second one allows court clerks to skip a current procedure which requires them, when somebody fails to appear in a traffic case, to schedule a hearing, and even though the person hasn't appeared, rather than defaulting, and allows them to proceed as they would in other violations cases. The person, when there's a default, gets an opportunity to go to DMV, sends them a notice that says you've got 60 days before we suspend your driving privileges to get something back to us from the courts. We haven't heard from you, the suspension will take effect automatically. Both of these issues were brought to us by court clerks. One of them was also brought to us by David Hendricks and by Honorable Carl Myers, who's a Kaiser Municipal Judge. Is that short enough?
That was great, Brad. That was terrific. Are there questions for Mr. Swine? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, and to the witness, and perhaps a point of inquiry to the Chair, and I'm wondering if these two sections are germane.
You're referencing the relating clause?
Yes.
Relating to consequences for failure to appear?
I'm just raising the question. I just it just popped in my mind. One instance where in the same bill, changing the grand jury proceedings, and another one we're not requiring trials in certain citations where the defendant doesn't appear. I don't see how these are related in any fashion. Is that an infirmity?
Well, that's an interesting question. I wish Mr. Taylor were here to help me respond. My understanding of the broad nature of the relating clause, well, here's Mr. Taylor now. I think that it probably is not a problem, and I know that legislative counsel judiciously guards their relating clause, but Representative Ackerman has posed the question about whether or not the sections in this bill are necessarily germane to the relating clause, Mr. Taylor.
I really can't. I think they are. I mean, I'd have to operate in the assumption that they
Chair
are.
Chair Williams.
I'd like to have looked at it for those purposes, but relating to the consequences to failure to appear, what was Mr. Representative?
I believe it was the section that dealt with the grand jury, changing the grand jury charge. Go ahead, Mr. Swank.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, if I may, they both relate to failure to appear proceedings, which is the grand jury proceeding is when court clerks appear on failure to appear proceedings that the grand jury has initiated. And in Section 2, it's what court clerks do when there's a failure to appear in a traffic case. So the relating clause relates to the failure to appear process, and that's all that either of the sections do.
Any further questions, Representative Ackerman? Does that satisfy you?
I'm not that familiar with this type of an issue, so I can't say I'm satisfied, but I'm more curious.
Right. Well, and I'd encourage you to make an inquiry to Legislative Counsel's office about this issue, because they're sort of the guardians of the relating clause in the germaneness issue within bills. Are there any other questions for Mr. Swank?
One very quick one.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Swank, I was reading the last paragraph of your testimony, your written testimony. It says, we believe Senate Bill 79 will make the process of addressing blah, blah, blah. I assume that's just a typo, and you still are talking about Senate Bill 74?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, that's correct.
Okay, just wanted to be sure. Thank you.
Any other questions? Great, thank you, Brad. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 74. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move Senate Bill 74 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 74 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none, the bill will move to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Krieger, in your day, did you give citations for traffic violations? Did you pass out a few of those in your day?
Yeah.
Then I think you're qualified to carry this bill to the full committee.
What are they laughing about?
You can talk about failure to appear. With that, we will now move to work session on House Bill 2355.
That's a big file.
Go ahead, counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2355 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and basically what it does is it codifies probably what the case law would be or is as it relates to allowing juveniles post-adjudication relief. You have a set of amendments in front of you, the Dash 1 amendments. I think you may want to hear from Mike Livingston also, because I received an email from him yesterday stating that we needed to add another amendment to the bill to ensure that there's a 2-year statute of limitations as it relates to post-adjudication relief. What the amendments do is they state that it takes out the age of under the age of 18. I think it's because you could have someone who was adjudicated delinquent just before their 18th birthday, then afterwards found out they had a constitutional right that was violated, they're now beyond the age of 18. They still would have the right to go back as post-adjudication relief. That's important now because of sentencing guidelines, and juvenile convictions do factor into the guidelines.
Okay. Please come forward, Ms. Lawrence. Welcome. Now, as I understood Mr. Taylor's comment, you believe that there are amendments necessary beyond the Dash 1 amendments we have before us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, in essence, a technical one. As originally drafted, the bill provided that persons under the age of 18 or still within the jurisdiction of the court sought post-adjudication relief in the juvenile court. For those over 18 and no longer within the jurisdiction of the court, that person would seek relief in the circuit court under the current post-conviction relief proceedings that apply to adults. After further review, the commission decided that there was no reason to bifurcate those proceedings because the juvenile court currently considers petitions for expunction of records for people over 18 and no longer within the court's jurisdiction, and also because the juvenile court is the place where the order or judgment being challenged was entered. And so that's the purpose for the Dash 1 amendments, which you have before you. After further discussion with Ann Christian, she pointed out that by moving the over 18 and no longer within the jurisdiction of the court people back in the juvenile court, one thing that we'd lost was the 2-year statute of limitation that would apply to those people. And that's what the additional amendment that Mr. Taylor referred to would do. It would basically, and I have it written out here, what it would do would be if the person seeking post-adjudication relief in the juvenile court is over 18 and no longer within the jurisdiction of the court, that petition must be filed within 2 years, and then it's the same dates it would apply in post-conviction for an adult. And it has both a fiscal and a policy impact. The fiscal is to reduce the cost because it cuts off at a period of 2 years the time within which the person can bring this petition. And in essence, looking back on it, it was an inadvertent omission in any event when we brought back in the older people to the juvenile court. And I do have it written out, and I think because it's a carbon copy of what's in 138.510, 3 and 4 right now, that legislative council can put that into the Dash 1s.
It always seems like it ought to be that easy, doesn't it? Never seem to have that same kind of luck. Are there questions from Mr. Livingston about potential amendment? Have you had an opportunity to review this with the work group from the Law Commission on this bill at all?
Senator, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe this just came up in the last day or two, and I believe Senator Brown is aware of the
Okay.
And Christian confirms that. And it's one that they approved of anyway with the original bill, because that limitation applied as the bill was originally drafted.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Livingston while we have him at the table? Great. Oh, please, counsel.
Michael, could you give me that citation again, 138.510 what?
Sub 3 and 4.
The two-year statute of limitation is in 138.510.3, and there's also I don't know what the proper term is, but a sort of a savings clause in 138.510.4. Those are that would cover individuals who would be prejudiced because of the effective date of the act. In other words, they wouldn't have the 2 year, and there's a model for it in subsection 4. Basically, the same limitation as in 3 and 4. And that would apply to persons over 18 and no longer within the jurisdiction of the court who are bringing this petition. And I apologize that we didn't catch that earlier in the transfer. And I appreciate Ms. Christian pointing that out.
Thank you, Mr. Livingston.
Thank you.
I'm just conversing with counsel about whether we ought to move the bill up to the full and catch the amendment at the full committee. I think that would be the chair's preference at this point, so we can get the process moving on this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
In that case, then, I would move the -1 amendments with the conceptual amendment proposed by Mr. Livingston.
We are.
House Bill 2355.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2355.
Just the -1s with the conceptual amendments first.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Yes. Representative Shetterly has moved the -1 amendments with the conceptual amendment proposed by Mr. Livingston to House Bill 2355. Is there any discussion about the motion?
Then we will see that in the fold before we pass the bill.
That's right.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Any objection? The -1s are adopted, as well as the conceptual amendment. Representative Shetterly.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2355 as amended, including the conceptual amendment, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2355 as amended, including the conceptual amendment, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Bill moves to the full committee. Any preference on carriers on this bill? Representative Shetterly, do you want to carry the bill?
Be glad to.
Okay. And we'll try to get the amendment before the full committee on Friday. Close the work session now on House Bill 2355 and open a work session on House Bill 2379.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2379 comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. You may remember the hearing we had a week or so ago on this bill. This relates to the issue of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle when a person is using the MAX or a bus. At your request, we had a work group afterwards, and you have the -1 amendments in front of you, which add to the bill, and I've set this forth in the staff measure summary too. It is, a person commits a crime. This would create the crime of interfering with public transportation and classifies the crime as a Class A misdemeanor. The person commits this crime if the person intentionally enters a public transit vehicle or station and the person has been lawfully excluded, B, intentionally interferes with the use of a public transportation vehicle, while in a public transit vehicle or station, recklessly creates a risk of public inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm by engaging in unruly, harmful, harassing behavior, and D, subjects another passenger of the transit or a transit employee to offensive physical contact. This provision is based on the disorderly conduct statute, but even more so than the disorderly conduct statute, it focuses on conduct as opposed to speech. I believe the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, they told me they're satisfied with the amendments, and there's someone from the Multnomah DA's office here. I think you may want to, he's just had a chance to look at these amendments this morning.
They did participate in the work.
They did,
Mr. Right?
Chairman's
Good.
Committee.
Good. Thanks. Please come forward and identify yourself for the record.
Hi, Cole Block, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, currently assigned to TriMet. Mr. Chair, Representatives, I took a look at the proposed amendments. The only suggestions I would have is if you look at subsection 3A, the first one, it says intentionally. It does not also have the knowingly and recklessly mental state elements. which can make it difficult to prosecute people in instances where they throw away their exclusion or ignore their exclusion and claim they never knew they were excluded, so they didn't intentionally violate this law. The trespass statute, if you look at it as it stands now, has all three mental states, making it easier to hold people accountable and closing some legal loopholes that they can claim they never knew they weren't supposed to be there. So if we could add the intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly mental state, that would make it easier to apply this statute. And also in B, subsection 3B, to add knowingly mental state, the situation where a person knowingly does something, for example, I've had cases where people stand in front of a bus because they have a disagreement with the bus operator, won't let the bus move. Their intent may not be to stop the bus. Their intent may be to talk to the bus driver or to annoy the bus driver, and they could use that as, a defense, saying, I was intending to interfere with transportation. I was intending to talk to the bus driver, so I stood in front of the bus, and I wouldn't move, so the police came and took me away. So we had a knowingly, that would close that loophole. Subsection D, it's come to my attention, this describes most of the people who work in the trans system. There's also another group known as rider advocates who are contracted through TriMet. They are not probably technically TriMet employees, but they ride on the buses and the trains in TriMet-type uniforms and assist people in riding trains and act somewhat in a security fashion, but they're not security officers, they're not TriMet employees, they're a private entity that contracts with TriMet, and they're put at risk because they usually ride the lines where we have the most trouble is where they'll be. So I'd ask that they be included in here to give them extra protection. And jumping back to subsection 3A, the term that's used there is a person who has been lawfully excluded. I think in addition to that, we may want to add the language excluded or trespassed. In some jurisdictions, they hand out a form that says you've been excluded. In some jurisdictions, they hand out a form that says you've been trespassed. I'm not sure what the legal definition, if there is one, for excluded is. And if we put excluded and trespass, it doesn't make it so no transit agency will have to go out and change or reprint their forms. They can use either excluded or trespass on the forms. I think everybody understands it has the same meaning. Those are the only suggestions I have at this time, although I haven't had a chance to look up any case law and see how it applies to the language here.
Questions? Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Weren't you involved in this work group?
I'm sorry?
Were you involved in the work group that worked on these amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I was. After your testimony last time, we got together, myself, Mr. Taylor, and a member of the OCDLA, and got together and basically drafted these amendments.
Well, I asked that question because you have a lot of changes that you wanted to make today, which surprises me because you were involved in the work group. Did you just get these amendments? Is that
correct? I got them this morning. These are not the same ones that were necessarily submitted last time. At some point, these got changed between when we got together and when I was able to get a copy here this morning.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike did send me a set. What we did is we worked on the amendments there. Anytime we work on the amendments, there's an understanding that Legislative Counsel's Office will refine the language. He did email me a set of amendments afterwards, which may have been, I think, his understanding of the meeting. The problem I had is I'd already sent the notes from our meeting immediately after the meeting to Legislative Counsel's Office. It was under the circumstances with all the bills that they're drafting now, it would have been possible for me to go back, compare the differences between the memos, and then ask them for changes.
I see.
And I just never would have got the amendments back in time, and nor could I get the work group back in time either.
Well, I appreciate that explanation. I'm just trying to be cognizant of the workload of LC and thought since they were all on the same page, we should have had an amendment that reflected that. But thank you for that explanation.
I just have a question. Down in sub D, the rider advocates, as you've described them, how do you recommend we best describe them by statute if they are not employees? I mean, do you want us to describe them as or contract personnel? I mean, how do you suggest we legally describe these people if we're going to include them in sub D?
Agents.
This agent, an agent of TriMet, that might work.
Mr. Chair, I think either language would be acceptable, a contract employee or agent of. I think agent might be a little more broad, which would be more likely to include the rider advocates than maybe contract employee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Taylor.
Mike, are these people paid?
They are.
So why wouldn't they be under the term employee?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, they are not employed by TriMet per se. They are a different organization or business that contracts out with TriMet. I mean, there certainly would be a legal argument they are employed by TriMet. I just don't want to leave a loophole down the road where someone can say this person isn't a TriMet employee because they don't have, when you look at who their employer is, who pays their bill, it's not TriMet. It is a different organization, different entity that employs the rider advocates. TriMet just pays that corporation to have these people ride the buses and trains.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would think that the employment department would say there is a fine technical distinction between an employee and a contracted agent.
I'm just sitting here wondering that if a rider advocate does something on a TriMet bus for TriMet, whether or not the Tort Claims Act and all that stuff applies. I mean, you could really go down an interesting road there that Bernie probably doesn't want us to go down as he's shaking his head back and forth right now. Well, that's fine. It sounds like obviously changing the current language of the amendments in A and B from intentionally to intentionally knowingly or recklessly and intentionally or knowingly may have a significant effect on whether or not OCDLA actually agrees with the amendments or not, because adding those additional provisions may give them some pause. So I guess what I'm going to ask Mr. Taylor is we'll close the public hearing and get new amendments drafted, and I'd ask you to sort of retouch base with the people who you had worked originally with these on to see where they're at. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2379. And I think that concludes our hearing for the day, committee. Thank you. Don't forget, we've got lunch with the Supreme Court today.